When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I am Dr. Melek Frataltay, a musician and a neuroscientist. Today I will be your host and we will be talking to Dr. Quinn Eastman about his new book, The Woman Who Couldn't Wake Up, Hypersomnia and the Science of Sleepiness, published by the Columbia University Press this year. Quinn Eastman is a technical editor at Emory University School of Medicine. He was trained as a biochemist, receiving a PhD from Yale University, and has worked as a journalist covering local government and environmental issues, as well as sleep research. The Woman Who Couldn't Wake Up tells Anna's story and the broader story of her diagnosis, idiopathic hypersomnia, a shadowy sibling of narcolepsy that has emerged as a focus of sleep research and patient advocacy. Quinn Eastman explores the science around sleepiness, recounting how researchers have been searching for more than a century for the substances that tip the brain into slumber. Hello, Quinn. How are you?
I'm glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. So before we start discussing your book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background?
I am a science writer. I've been working at Emory University for a long time. I have some experience in the lab a long time ago, which serves me well. But I've transitioned to writing about science and biomedical research a while ago, and that's what I do.
And do you miss doing research in a lab?
Just doing things with your hands a little bit, and also, you know, kind of going where clues take you. Some of the stuff that they do now in the laboratory, I don't know how to do it. We can talk about it later, with some of the genetics I'm trying to kind of get in through the back door, to try doing some research again, but technology has advanced, and I need to catch up.
And how did you come to write The Woman Who Couldn't Wake Up? And why did you decide to write it now?
Well, the book grew out of a story that I was following at Emory as part of being a science writer at the medical school there. And it has kind of three strands. One is the personal story of Anna Sumner, who's the woman in the title, the woman who couldn't wake up, and she was in a crisis basically, and some doctors were able to help her and get her through that. And but the her personal story links to two other things. One was this mysterious sleepy stuff that was detected in her cerebrospinal fluid, and which the researchers thought was making her sleepy. And this idea has this long history, but the researchers were never able to, or have not so far been able to announce what this stuff is, although they have a lot of clues. So there's this history of researchers who study sleep isolating these substances which are connected with sleep to say that they embody sleepiness. And, you know, so that what they found with Anna kind of links back to that whole idea. And then the other one is the story of her diagnosis, which is idiopathic hypersomnia. And, you know, at the when I was started on following the story, you know, people with idiopathic hypersomnia, there really wasn't much for them in terms of information about what they should, what kind of care they should receive. There weren't support groups. There weren't really any organizations for them. And that, over the course of me following the story, that changed. And that's kind of one of the biggest kind of positive outcomes that I point to in the book, is that, you know, even if the scientific detective story was not resolved, there is at least that it let was the formation of a community, and the people now have kind of a representation and can find out more about what other people are dealing with, and that's a good thing.
So actually, this leads the conversation to a very interesting question. So why do we actually sleep, and what makes us become sleepy? Do the scientists exactly understand this?
Well, there are some good ideas about why we sleep. I think the short answer is because our brains and bodies need it to, there's an idea that sleep is necessary to sort of recalibrate the synapses in the brain and make everything right again so that we can accumulate more memories and so that our brains work properly. But you know, the broader question of why we sleep, and some parts of sleep, why we have REM sleep, why we have dreams, those questions are still really unanswered, although there are a lot of kind of evolutionary and physiological clues. We know that sleep is needed for us to, you know, consolidate memories and to recuperate and to have proper function of our bodies. And that's true across, you know, many kinds of animals too. But the full biology of it is still being unraveled. But as to what makes us fall asleep, that is better known, but in terms of all the puzzle pieces, they're not all in place, but there's a good picture of it in terms of there's one part of the brain which is sort of the central control box, and that's the hypothalamus. And there's part of the hypothalamus that becomes active when we fall asleep. It's the preoptic area, and it makes that part of the brain sends out signals that sort of cool down the rest of the brain and says time to shift gears. And then there are a lot of theories about all the mixture of these two basic forces, being one of them being sleep pressure. So when we've stayed awake for a long time, we get sleepier and sleepier. So there's sleep pressure, and there's also the circadian clock. You know, in the middle of the day, we're likely to be awake, and then in the middle of the night, we're likely to be asleep. So those two basic forces. We have, you know, scientists are kind of on, are taking apart all of those. And we have a good idea about what the parts of the puzzle are. But important to recognize that sleep pressure is not just one thing. And that's something that I think that some other books on sleep don't really do that well. There's a molecule in the brain called adenosine, and there are receptors for it, and it builds up, or at least there's more activity for it when people stay awake for a long time. But sleep pressure and sleepiness is not just one thing. And it's not just adenosine. There are little enzymatic modifications and changes in receptors and synapses all over the brain, which are part of sleepiness too.
And then, of course, in your book, you present the story, as you mentioned, of Anna Sumner, and then discuss the story or the history of idiopathic hypersomnia. So that's a mouthful, isn't it? Could you tell us a little bit about what this involves exactly? Where did the concept of idiopathic hypersomnia come from? How many people are affected worldwide, and what are the symptoms? How do you describe this disease or this condition?
Well, there are a lot of parts to your question. Idiopathic hypersomnia is kind of, there's a tension there between it being a well-defined condition with a bunch of symptoms, and then sort of a leftover category about people who go through a diagnostic process and they don't meet the criteria for sleep apnea or narcolepsy, but in a certain certain test in the sleep laboratory, they fall asleep quickly. So they meet these criteria for idiopathic hypersomnia. So they get that diagnosis. If we look back, the reason why there's this diagnosis, the name is from, it comes from a neurologist in Cold War era Czechoslovakia named Bedřich Roth. And he was important in the study of sleep because he had a clinic in Prague devoted to sleep disorders, specifically narcolepsy and hypersomnia, before a lot of other clinicians. And he was part of a kind of an early group that called the Rechtschaffen Kales Committee that kind of defined how we use EEGs to monitor sleep. And he was the person who really introduced this concept of idiopathic hypersomnia into the scientific literature. Although he wrote about people with what we would call IH starting in the 50s, but I don't think it was called that actually until the 1970s. And so Roth was kind of this outsider because he was in Czechoslovakia, and a very influential group in terms of kind of standardizing sleep medicine was a group of people at Stanford in California. And they were more focused on narcolepsy and sleep apnea. And so there's kind of with Roth having this kind of this concept of people who had symptoms. It's important to recognize that Roth was interested in narcolepsy too, and that was actually what attracted him to sleep medicine in the first place. But he recognized fairly early on that there were, you know, people from all over the country were being referred to him, sleepy people, and some of them were kind of on the other side of a spectrum of sleepiness from narcolepsy. And for him, hypersomnia meant people who, like they didn't fall asleep quickly necessarily, but sleep was taking over their life. And it was more about the duration of sleep rather than the intensity of the sleep attack. And so he also, and he also defined this, he described this symptom called sleep drunkenness. And that's in some, like in this key publication in the 1950s, which I had translated in the book to see who, you know, who are these people? And sleep drunkenness is sort of this state where people are half awake but and half asleep. It's like the brain makes this transition out of sleep partway and then gets stuck. And that's that they're not coordinated or they can't really talk or they and it's when they may be physically awake and you know sitting up, but they're not fully aware. And so that's this state that he described so well, and it's characteristic of idiopathic hypersomnia, that and the need for long sleep duration. People with kind of classic narcolepsy don't sleep more for every 24 hours than healthy or neurotypical people, because they also have disrupted nighttime sleep. They're very sleepy. They can transition into sleep quickly, but they don't sleep more. So on the other side of the spectrum, people with hypersomnia, they can be sleeping 10, 12, 14 hours a day. And when they wake up, they say, you know, I need more. I don't feel rested. So it's kind of, it's qualitatively different than narcolepsy. And Rote was kind of important in recognizing that and communicating that to other specialists.
And was this the case with Anna Sumner as well? She was sleeping.
So the thing that was helpful for Anna is that she did not go through this journey of being having a detour. When she came in and saw the people at Emory, she was diagnosed with idiopathic hypersomnia, and she didn't go on this detour where they said, well, you actually have you probably have a form of depression, or you have sleep apnea, or you have something else, some metabolic problem. And which a lot of people go through those detours, but she didn't go through these detours. What did happen is that she was treated in terms of managing her symptoms with first modafinil and then conventional stimulants, and those didn't really help her. They helped her get through the day, but they backfired. She needed higher doses. She experienced crashes, and the sleepiness was still there. It was kind of even increasing in response. So that kind of led to this, you know, moment of where the clinicians decided that they needed to take a different strategy.
And how many others are there like Anna in the world? Do we know? In your book, for example, you mentioned that there is now an idiopathic hypersomnia community getting together for patient advocacy.
That's right. So the current estimates are in the United States are that about 1 in 10,000 people within, but this is an estimate that comes from looking at insurance databases. So 1 in 10,000 people, and that is less than kind of conventional narcolepsy, which, but it has been going up in recent years. And there's also, so there's some caveats to that. One is that IH is partially a creation of the healthcare system, and that so how the prevalence in other countries, it's probably somewhat similar, but it's going to be different. So we don't know what it's like in outside the United States so much. And it's also the case that a lot of people with idiopathic hypersomnia were diagnosed with other things. And there's kind of this overlap with narcolepsy. And then sometimes they get diagnosed with something else because it would help them get medication and then get insurance company reimbursement for it. That has changed over the last few years, and there is now even an FDA approved medication. But I think that state of being kind of under the table, where people were getting different diagnoses because of the insurance obstacles, there will be a hangover for that for a long time.
Well, actually, that's more common than I was expecting. Do we now have a better understanding as to what causes idiopathic hypersomnia? Are there genetic factors or environmental, or do we know the underlying causes?
There are kind of these two basic ideas that about it being kind of either inborn or acquired. And then there's an idea that it's kind of similar to narcolepsy, at least the most distinctive form of narcolepsy, where there's either an infection or inflammation, and that does something to the brain. And then that changes how sleep is regulated. And then just recently, from Japan, there's been a study showing that a fraction of people with idiopathic hypersomnia have a mutation in what's called a gene for orexin. And that is a peptide produced in the brain that helps keep us awake. And it has a very important role in narcolepsy, in terms of that the neurons that produce it are lost. But that's not what's happening in these folks. They have a mutation that kind of interferes with the proper production of the peptide. This was exciting, not because it explained so much, but because it was the first genetic study of idiopathic hypersomnia that found anything at all. And I don't think that genetics are responsible for most of IH, but I think that's where the field should go, and partially. And there's a group at UCSF, at University of California, San Francisco, that has had remarkable success studying families of people who have particular distortions of sleep. And that means people who have who go to sleep very early or go to sleep very late. And then more recently, they study people who have what they call familial short sleep. That is to say, people who only need 4 or 5 hours of sleep per night, and then they're healthy, even though they only get that small amount. And so IH is arguably kind of the opposite, that people with IH need just much more sleep than the average person. And so there are, in the literature, there are examples of people of multiplex families, people who you know, their mother and their aunt and their sister all have similar diagnosis. And I think that now we can do genetic studies that allow us to find the responsible genes. I don't think that most people with an IH diagnosis will that genetics will be the main driving factor, but this kind of study can tell us a lot, and I think that's where the field should go.
Well, I wish I could make it with 4 hours of sleep a day as well.
Yeah, I've read some articles about the people who are these families, members of these families, and they're executives at companies, and they go on wilderness adventures, and then they do all this other, like they stay busy.
That's impressive.
And that's always, you know, that's always the thing that comes out of some of this sleep research is that the things that you find out about these very rare cases can maybe provide some insights that will help other people, just in the same way that people who study these. The researchers who study these very rare cases of hypercholesterolemia have led to statins and more recent cholesterol reducing drugs. I think that these kinds of studies of sleep genetics can really point the way to a better understanding of just how all of our bodies regulate sleep.
Absolutely. And what about treatment methods? Could IH be cured or treated? Do we have any effective approaches, therapeutics?
I think IH can be managed for some folks. Effectively, but that is definitely a work in progress. The story that is described in my book about some of the more unconventional approaches that had to be tried, that shows how there was an unmet need, definitely. And also that conventional stimulants are really unsatisfactory for a lot of people. But those are the tools that a lot of physicians have familiarity with or experience with. So that's what they go to first. And it's also kind of just easier for people to do these conventional stimulants because a lot of people with ADHD get prescribed them. And it's just kind of there's an institutional inertia allowing people to do that versus anything else. There's the drug companies and then there's the clinicians. The clinicians who treat people with sleep disorders have agreed that modafinil is probably a good first line choice as far as what people with a new IH diagnosis could try. It doesn't work for everybody, but it can help them stay awake and get through the day. It also has, some safety issues as far as some rare skin reactions. On the other side, there's a relatively new, couple years ago, FDA approval for what's called oxybate, which is a medication that had been used a lot in the narcolepsy community for a long time, for the last 20 years. And now it's available now it's in a low sodium form because this medication was basically a salt and the people who were taking it, say 10 years ago, had to drink that. It was so salty that they were getting more sodium from that than what was recommended for their diet. And so the company that was manufacturing it, they came up with the low sodium version. And this is kind of an interesting parallel to some other medications in that it works in terms of controlling the symptoms for a lot of people who need it, but this medication has some safety issues in terms of when it's combined with other drugs, and it's a fairly strong sedative, so it can knock you out basically. It's also very expensive, so there are a lot of issues with this medication. It's for some people it helps them, and the fact that a company was able to get the FDA to approve this is remarkable. But I think that people with IH diagnoses, they need more options. And I think that that will happen in the next few years, because other companies are pursuing an approval for the IH indication, and those options will develop.
I guess there are still lots to discover on this condition. Have you found out anything that surprised you during the research for this book?
Well, a lot of things didn't turn out like the way that I hoped or the way that I expected. When I started working on the book, I thought that the researchers who I was following, I thought they were going to find the mysterious sleepy stuff that they were looking for. That didn't turn out to be the case. Although they have made some steps, and for example, David Rye, who is the neurologist, who's kind of the protagonist for part of the book in terms of helping Anna Sumner and then driving the research into this mysterious sleepy stuff, and which was responsible for Anna's sleepiness and possibly other people's. So he's gotten to the point where at a conference, he showed a bunch of data. He said that he was able to identify this, possibly able to identify this stuff, but he wouldn't say what it was. And I hope that he can get to the point where he will be able to publish what this stuff is. That I'll have to check back with him and see where that stands. There was a lot that I had to cut out, actually. Also, for example, something that happened, I thought there was a kind of a weird medication that was being developed in a clinic. It was being tested in some clinical trials. It was the first drug that was specifically tested, that was tested in a clinical trial aimed at people with idiopathic hypersomnia. And that is pentylene tetrazole. And that drug has this kind of weird history. It was used to trigger seizures in people with schizophrenia in the 1930s. Then later it was marketed to elderly people as being this mild stimulant. It turns out that if injecteth a lot of it, it triggers seizures. If you take smaller amounts by mouth, it doesn't trigger seizures and seems to be relatively safe. So the medical world has a lot of experience with this stuff. And I thought that it might get approved, but the company behind it, first they were trying to develop this as kind of a cognitive enhancer for people with Down syndrome. Then they pivoted and developed it for idiopathic hypersomnia. Eventually, the company didn't get the results they wanted, and the company dissolved. So that was another, twist in the story. There were a lot of other things that, they didn't turn that out like I hoped or I expected. What was funny was one of the people I talked to in early on was Don Blywise, who's a sleep researcher and a colleague of David Rise and the other people at Emory. And he was suggesting, well, if you wait a few more years, some of these mysteries may be solved, or some of these issues may be worked out. And I thought, well, I can't wait that long because, I've been the important stuff is happening right now. and so I had to kind of tie a lot of strands together, even though maybe, some of the mysteries were not all resolved.
Well, let's see if more information will be available for us on this very unusual condition, let's say. And what are you currently working on? What's your next project?
I'm trying to figure that out. One topic which I think could be done, which hasn't been done, is I noticed that there's a good book length histories of other neurological conditions, such as, say, multiple sclerosis, but there is not really an accessible book length history of narcolepsy. And narcolepsy has been this, it's an interesting story because if you compare it to, it's something where there are cells that make something important in the brain, and something happens and they go missing. And it's a way of looking at neurological disease that actually is a scientific success story, but that success took a long time to happen. If compare it to, say, Parkinson's disease, you have cells that make something important, dopamine, they get attacked or they degenerate, and then there's a way to address that the neurochemical deficiency. It's not perfect. People still they can't reverse Parkinson's, but the kind of the scientific and medical paradigm of there being this thing that you can replace, that is remarkable. With lots of other, psychiatric, neuropsychiatric conditions, there's not something you can replace so simply. So narcolepsy is this is kind of this amazing story, and I think maybe that could be a book. I was just in touch with someone who is a very important part of that study, who's writing, writing his own memoir. So, and I'm not involved in that. So I don't know what tactic I will take, but there's some work to be done in terms of historical papers, getting archives from some of the advocacy groups that have been involved in this for a long time. And then more broadly, I just like to do some more freelancing, and I've developed this niche of kind of sleep-related neuroscience, and I'd like to keep working on that.
Sounds very exciting. Well, Quinn, thank you very much for joining us today.